Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 88 of Registry Matters. This is the real 88, Larry. Last time you tried to trick me with the fake 88.
This is the real 88.
This is the real 88. How are you?
Well, I'm doing fine, except for a tooth that's giving me a little bit of problem.
I don't think your shower head thing can fix this.
No, I don't think that. But this was a good one on me, though. So for those of you who have ever had a root canal, you probably don't try to have it if you can avoid them. So I had a root canal in 1974 in one of my rear molars, and the crown eventually came off here a few weeks ago, and I went to the dentist, and the dentist told me that he said, well, you only had a partial root canal in 1974. He said, I would advise you to have a root canal now. Before he said, I don't advise crowning that tooth again. I said, well, you know, that's really nice of you. I appreciate your advice. I said, but I'd like to crown the tooth again. And we'll see what happens. I said, what is the probability it's going to flare up? He said, the probability is better that it will than it won't. I said, well, avoiding a root canal is worth it. I said, so I'm going to take my chance. He said, well, then, you're going to take a chance on destroying the tooth, the crown. He said, well, then we can avoid that by just putting it on with temporary cement. And I said, how quickly will the flare-up come? He said, probably within a month. I said, all righty. Well, then we'll put the crown on with temporary cement. And I said, and then we'll see who gets to be right. I said, either I'll be right or you'll be right. And, well, it's been just shy of a month, and the tooth has begun to flare up. So it looks like I'm going to have to go back to the dentist and say, you told me so. So, but the only difference is when someone tells me so and I'm wrong, I'll go back and say, yep, you told me so. Not a problem for me at all. Yeah, his experience was unique on 30 years of it. I have told dentists on other things where I thought that we could do it a different way. And most of the time until now I've been right. But on this time, it appears that unless it magically cures itself, which it's not going to, I'm going to have a root canal.
That is super exciting because root canals are the best thing ever.
So, but I do not expect him to say, I told you so, because I'm going to say, you told me so. And it won't be necessary for him to say that.
This is right. Oh, so you're going to beat him to the punch.
I'm going to say, here I am, and you told me so.
Well, hey, Larry, we have some amazing breaking news. And this is if you haven't heard of this yet, especially by the time you get this podcast, you're living under a rock. That's for darn sure.
Well, this would definitely be firing up the news sounder for this.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You couldn't hear it. Hey, the news sounder did play, though.
It was there in the background.
I know. No. I didn't have it pushing out. But, there was this guy, Jeffrey Epstein, we've talked about kind of recently. He was allegedly trafficking in young underage girls for prostitution and whatnot. He decided to commit suicide today in a federal prison. Or jail, I guess it would be. Federal holding? What's it called?
Well, it serves both purposes. It holds people that have been convicted, but mostly pretrial detention in Metropolitan and Manhattan. The Metropolitan Correctional Center in Manhattan. I don't think we can be completely clear. It's a suicide. I've heard some banter out there that it might have been assisted. But,
right.
But we'll have to wait till the official report comes out.
Yes. And so we'll get more into that at the end of the show, but we just wanted to tease that up front because that, as far as like late-breaking news, that probably is one of the biggest things that we've ever had happen, especially the day of the show.
Yes, and this would definitely be big news because the ramifications I'm going to talk about later when I read my statement are going to be so horrendous that it's going to be we'll hear about Epstein for a long time to come.
Right. But on another note, then we have Mike, who is a longtime patron out of New Jersey, and he's going to join us at least for a little while, and I think he's going to stick around for the whole thing. But he is a truck driver, and it seemed appropriate. We do get comments. I'm sure you do at like the NARSA level, like, oh my God, what am I supposed to do? No one will hire me, this and that. I know that truck drivers are like in super heavy demand. And it seems like one of those kind of fields that doesn't require a lot of background checks necessarily, depending on where. And also it doesn't require a lot of education or training and so forth. So it's a low barrier to get into and it pays reasonably well. So we've got Mike joining us. Hello, Mike. How are you?
Hi, Andy. How are you doing today?
Doing very well. And you were fortunate. I was fortunate about, 3 weeks ago? You were in town. And so we had lunch, dinner a couple times.
Yep. Yeah, and it was very nice to meet you.
And you said I was taller.
Yeah, and a little bit older than I thought you were.
Oh man, wait. Why don't you twist that while it's in my back? Can you do that
Okay.
for me real quick? Thanks.
Sure.
But you had an interesting little transition halfway recently in your job situation from an over-the-road driver to what did you just get certified as?
I got certified as hazmat, which means I can legally transport a bomb around the country with basically explosives, radioactive materials, almost anything. And I just happen to be looking for a local job so I can be home every day transporting fuel to gas stations.
All right, now I've met you, and the thought of you transporting a bomb sounds horrifying.
Why? I drive actually very well.
Just kidding, I'm just messing with you. Well, why wouldn't you be able to do hazmat, just generally speaking, being one of quote unquote our people?
Well, that I have no idea. The guidelines for this goes through the TSA, the Transportation Safety Administration. It's actually federal government, which is part of the Homeland Security Department. So you have to get fingerprints done and you have to go through a background check. There are some crimes that you can commit that permanently ban you, and a link to those will be in the show notes. But just a quick overview of it. It's the espionage, drug manufacturing, stuff like that will keep you permanently disqualified from getting a hazmat endorsement. And your major league felonies, your four-star felonies will usually require you to be out of prison for at least 5 years, which I just celebrated,
Good for you.
and at least 7 years from your last conviction.
Okay.
I don't think you can. I don't know what it says in there. If Larry looks over it, he could probably be more specific about it. But I don't see anything in there that says about being on parole or probation, just released from prison or a conviction date. So it is possible that somebody might be able to get it, but then your state might put a restriction on it.
Right. Larry, do you want to chime in?
Well, I would say that those who are under supervision probably are not going to be afforded the opportunity to travel out of the state. There are a few exceptions, but that's very tightly regimented. But those who are off all forms of supervision. But Mike, what about if you're in a state, if you're doing over the road and you happen to be in a state more than 24 hours, how do you deal with the burst of radiation that suddenly comes out of your body? And all of a sudden the Geiger counters light up and they come swarming in to say you're here on the 24-hour and you're 1 minute over. What do you do about that?
Well, that's where Larry is actually giving out fake news because I told him the other day that I actually did buy a Geiger counter. And when I crossed state lines, I in fact did not emit radiation.
What? I've heard of this. I've heard of like, that 72, the 48 hours that you like light everything up and there are like predator drones flying around like we got one. Go in, target.
But on the perception is reality on that, and for a lot of people, and the fear of the consequences are so horrendous that people would worry about that. So it would be a consideration for people who were going to drive, particularly I think in states where it's a really short window of time. I know we've got the 48-hour state in Nevada, but the reality is that I have yet to see a criminal prosecution, and I'm challenging the listeners to please provide me one where it says offender was in our state 73 hours and we discovered them and they were here temporarily, but that's irrelevant. They were here 73 hours. If that's the basis for the prosecution, I've never seen it on the National Criminal Defense Lawyers listserv. I've never seen it on our state criminal defense lawyers listserv. I have never heard about it on the NARSL listserv. I have never heard about one of these prosecutions where they just simply were in a state for a few hours beyond whatever time that they require in that state. In some many states, it's not even clear what's required because there is no provision for being present. It's just that these practices have sprung up where law enforcement have said, well, it stands to reason if you have to register within 72 hours of becoming a resident, it stands to reason, in our opinion, that you have to register within 72 hours of being physically present. But the law doesn't actually say that. But in terms of as you're driving, would you as a driver or are you going to find yourself in a position where either A, you would be in a state too long, or B, you might have a provision in some states where notify your departing state that you're going to be out of state. So if the state of Alabama says you're going to leave, if you're going to leave our state, you have to give a travel obtain a travel permit, even though you're not under supervision. That would pretty well knock that person out in Alabama if they were based there, wouldn't it?
I would imagine so. It would depend on the laws in your state. Luckily for me, I'm not on probation. I'm not on parole. I maxed out my time. So only the registration requirements affect me. And in New Jersey, for me, they're actually pretty lax because my conviction was back in the 90s before all of this happened. So I don't have to report when I'm leaving the state. I don't have any residency restrictions. A lot of that stuff doesn't affect me. Anything with the internet, I don't have to tell them anything about it. If they want to search anything, they got to treat me like anybody else, get a warrant. And I had to use the internet for my job just to transmit documents and such. But as far as a job for people, you would think that people would actually want people on the registry to have these types of jobs, because when you have a federal law that says now your driving has to be monitored and
right.
When you drive, where you stop, it's all GPS monitored, everything. You think they would love that?
Well,
because now they get to know where you are, even if you aren't subject to GPS regulations like they have in some states.
Now you're talking crazy talk. Now that makes too much sense.
I was just going to say, Larry, can we like introduce policies in states that say, hey, if you're on the registry, you will be a truck driver for hazmat. That way we can monitor you all the time.
well, a lot of things. I mean, what you say makes perfect sense. That having a job like that from the registrant's point of view, since your truck is monitored, if someone were to make an allegation against you and you say that you did something in Kansas City and the GPS showed you were never anywhere near Kansas City, they would have to put forth a theory that your truck self-operated itself, absent your presence, and you somehow got into Kansas City. And I mean, it would serve as a protection for those. But this is a field where the population of truck drivers is aging so rapidly that they're so desperate for drivers that I would think that they would be willing to take the opportunity to hire people even with this type of conviction, because they need warm bodies setting these cabs. If they don't have that, they're going to have to put a driverless vehicles on the road because they just don't have the it's like many of our professions where the people that occupy those professions, they're shrinking in numbers because of their age. The farming community is dying. That's an older profession by and large. Truck drivers are aging out.
You mean there's farmers still? the food just doesn't come from the grocery stores?
Well, it does just come from the grocery stores, but the people who work those fields, even though they operate nice, elaborate machinery, it's still done by a lot of human involvement, and those humans are by and large are older and older and older are doing those jobs.
And a lot of it came through me too, because I used to have a route going from New Jersey to California and back. And on the way back, I would bring produce back, tomatoes, oranges, strawberries, anything produce.
Let me ask you this question. And I want to avoid getting into your personal details, but can you speak in a general sense about the pay range for someone? If you are, let's say you're a non-hazmat driver and you're driving local, just like, I don't know, like a gravel truck or something like that, moving on up to and over the road and then moving in, I'm assuming that there's bonus money, so to speak, for being hazmat.
Not necessarily. Most bonuses for companies come from safety bonuses. So if you don't speed, you don't get tickets, you follow safety regulations, all of that, then usually you get a quarterly bonus or maybe even a monthly bonus, depending on how long you've been there. But as far as the hazmat right now, the pay is going to be about the same as I made before. But I'm going to have the benefit of being home every day.
Right.
I'm going to have the benefit of being an employee instead of an independent contractor, and I'm going to have a lot better medical and dental and everything insurance.
Okay. Do you think that since your conviction was so far long ago, do you think, you know, if someone only had like a 5-year, and I don't want to say only as in like only, but yours was so much longer ago versus so much more recent, do you think that impacts how much you have been afforded the privilege, if that's the right way to word it?
Yes. I do. Actually, my attorney thinks that I am the only person in New Jersey that has such lax restriction.
Interesting.
It's actually now in New Jersey, everybody that's on the registry that committed a crime after a certain date is going to be lifetime parole. So that's going to be a very hard thing to deal with.
How much time does it take to get your CDL?
I got mine with my studies on my own. It took me about probably about a month. And which, if you go to the school, you could probably do it in about 6 weeks.
Okay.
You can probably get a government assistance with it if you go to the class and do all the stuff you're supposed to do. Unfortunately, I didn't qualify for that. I had to pay it out of pocket. It cost me about $3,500.
But I mean, it sounds like, forget the part that you don't have $3,500, but it's a really strong return on investment. I'm not trying to, like I said, I mean, is it a $10 an hour job? Is it a $20 an hour job?
No. Okay. Well, we can get kind of specific. My first job was driving a bus. I would make $14 an hour.
Okay.
Then when I started to drive a truck, I made 40 cents a mile and I could drive about 600 miles a day. So figure it out. That's a little less than $300 a day, close to 250,
not bad.
Which isn't that bad. Then we came to drive. When I started driving solo, I made a flat rate per day of $275 a day, whether I drove 400 miles or 25 miles. Now the job that I'm going to get during training, they pay $20 an hour. When you become a regular driver, they pay $24.50 an hour, and then you can legally work 70 hours a week. Overtime starts at 50 hours with time and a half.
Okay.
So if you really want to work and maximize your hours, you can make six figures easy.
Hmm. And that gets even better if you have like a partner driver, right?
Well, for what I'm doing, you wouldn't have a partner driver, and no, not necessarily, because if the truck keeps moving, the companies usually figure out what the truck makes, and then you split it up between the drivers.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So you're not going to really get any better with what they call team driving.
Gotcha. Larry, do you have anything else?
Well, I think that's good information, particularly when you get into that $24.50 an hour range. That's some impressive money.
Yep, that's like 50 grand.
Right. No, that's more, a year. No, that's more than 90.
24 an hour is about 50 grand a year when you count like a 40 hour work week.
Oh yeah, we don't do 40 hour work weeks. That's for regular people.
Oh wait, you're an irregular person?
No, truck drivers work truck drivers work 70 hours a week.
Oh, okay. Because you're paid being on the road, not moving the truck. Yes?
Right. Yes. When you get paid by the mile, fair, then that's when you get – that's the most dangerous way to pay a driver, because then they're going to start speeding through construction zones. They're going to do everything they can do to game the system to make that money.
No.
Now, if I'm stuck in traffic, I don't care anymore because – I'm making a flat rate.
What do you think? Okay, so in chat, someone just said that someone says that the class is available around that area. This is in the Maryland area. Turned him down. He couldn't even get into CDL classes.
I find it hard to believe that a class that you would pay for would turn you down, because that's like a store saying that they're not going to sell you groceries. Now, I could see a company not training you or not paying you because they don't want to hire you. That's the one other thing. I'm sorry. This is going to take a little bit longer that I wanted to get into. It is harder to get a job when you're on the registry or a felon in general, because it's the insurance from the company that basically limits what jobs you have. Any of the big companies like Swift, US Express, any of those, you're not going to get a job there. Walmart.
Yeah.
You're not going to.
So you're
get
looking
a job
for a mom and pop kind of group, right?
Right. Or if you're lucky enough to be able to get your own truck and do what you got to do. But that is going to probably be, out of everybody that's registered, I would say maybe one or two people.
Right.
But yes, you would look for a smaller company. What I told people that have felony convictions, I say, when you drive down the road, look for the trailers that have dents in them. And those are the companies that you probably want to try to work for, because they might hire you.
Gotcha. And just to complete that whole thought, a friend of mine here in Georgia, he is he's a day driver, but he hits the immediately surrounding states, and he's still on supervision, and he gets like a monthly travel permit. So he is, okay. He hits North Carolina. I think he hits the top of Florida. I don't know if he hits Alabama or not, but he just knows that the way he has to time it, I don't think he spends the night, but he has to then take into account the being, you can't drive for more than 8 or 10 hours, whatever it is. He has to time that right for where his load gets dropped off.
11 hours.
Whatever. Yeah. So, but, and he makes decent money. I mean, it's not, you're not going to make a fortune. You're not going to be Jeffrey Epstein, but you're going to live pretty comfortable, decently comfortable. Yes. Certainly better than working at a loading dock making $7.50 an hour or whatever.
Or work in some place where you got to say you want fries with
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Do you want to supersize that? Right on. Larry, are you ready to dive into these articles?
I reckon so.
And you have thoroughly read and vetted them all?
I have not. It has been a horrendous week for me here, because our staff attorney is having to defend her own husband in
yes.
a vicious system that is disregarding everything that this country stands for in the way of due process. So we have been working on that case. As horrible as I am as an emotional support person, I have been trying to do my best to provide that. And it would be very, very, very stressful to go through what she's been going through. Her husband was yanked out of here last Friday with no notice, because he was going to be transported to Georgia.
Right, and he got extradited,
last,
right?
But, well, it's not really extradition. It was a transport, a retaking. But he got transported to Georgia. So for 8 days until this morning, we didn't know where he was.
Oh, my God, it took 8 days?
Well, that's the way the private companies work. They do efficiency, not direct route. So they meander around wherever they have prisoners to pick up.
Do you remember way back in our history, I don't know, episode 10 or 15 or something, that we covered something about a prison transport van that they were like locked in this sweltering van for like 20 or 30 days just to go from West Virginia to Texas?
Yeah, I vaguely remember that. There's been some good jury verdicts on these, what happens in these vans in the prisoner transport companies. We're starting to improve their processes, and we're going to hope to improve their processes even further when this is done, because already we know enough about what ensued. But that's really been distracting for me, in addition to my regular work, in addition to so it's like we've got an ambitious litigation agenda in our state, and we just can't get started until we get this matter resolved in Georgia.
Well, all right, so I guess I'll have to cut you some slack, since you were doing something not emotional, but sort of on the personal side, but not really.
Well,
but
I'm doing a lot of the legal writing. I have to take the emotion out of. She's crafting up stuff, and I said, nope, can't say that. Nope, can't say right. that either. Nope, you have to actually say this. Nope, you can't do that. And right. and it's difficult when you're trying to represent someone you have a deep emotional connection with. And
yep.
So I'm on her team of lawyers for her case.
Gotcha. Well, the first article that we have is coming from the New York Times, and the title is "A Relentless Jailhouse Lawyer Propels a Case to the Supreme Court." So here's a cat that had been in prison for 23 years, and he spends all of his time law library helping folks out, and eventually gets hooked up with a street lawyer, a belt and suspenders lawyer. I hear this expression. I don't know what belt and suspenders lawyer means. Do you, Larry? Does that mean anything?
I have no idea what that means.
Okay. And but the main point that I want out of this article is there's a quote in there that says, from well before I was involved, the attorney says, Calvin, the person that we're speaking about, his name is Calvin Duncan. Calvin understood that this was a winning legal issue, speaking to the article. How to frame it, raise it, and challenge it and challenge the non-unanimous law. And I wanted to like key in on this how to frame it thing, as far as you have to, you can't just say, hey, this sucks, I don't like it, it's unconstitutional, but you have to figure out how to put the points in the right place in the right order to almost like, you know, a debate team. You have to know how to argue your things.
That is correct. The best legal minds oftentimes get that out of kilter. They don't understand that you have to. I mean, Paul Dubling, who many of our supporters and listeners are familiar with, out of Chapel Hill, North Carolina, he says you have to argue to your audience. And the Supreme Court of the United States currently tends to be on the more conservative side, and you have to figure out what is going to appeal to them. But it also has to have some legal basis to it. Figuring out how to cast a constitutional argument. Hopefully, those that listened last week realized that just because you don't like something doesn't make it unconstitutional.
Well, so you have to be stupid but constitutional.
And plenty of things are stupid but constitutional. So when you manage to get to the high court, which is exceedingly rare, how many cases get there? 80 to 90 per year. When you get to the high court, you better have your arguments succinct, and you better have arguments that appeal to this type of justice. You got to get at least five of them.
Yeah,
in most instances, sure. You got to have at least five. And he knew he had a winning issue, but he knew how to frame, or at least assisted in framing the issue. I think that we could talk about that in the case of the Maryland versus Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services. We had a winning issue. In that case, and the state started trying to invent issues to argue emotion and argue bullshit. And I don't know if I can say that on the podcast, but we stuck to the issues that there's no federal registry, and we stuck to the principle of state control, federalism, and we argued that, and we prevailed in that case because we stuck to the actual facts and not the emotion. And you need to learn that when you go to the Supreme Court, emotion is not going to carry you through to the victory line in most instances.
It seemed to work pretty well for Kavanaugh during his Senate confirmation. No, it wasn't a confirmation hearing. It was just a hearing. That wasn't a confirmation hearing, was it?
That was the part of the confirmation. Okay, hearing. The public. Yes.
Go ahead, Mike.
I thought that was a committee hearing.
Well, that's the confirmation. When you go through the Judiciary Committee of the Senate, and then the committee takes its vote to refer move the nomination forward with a recommendation to confirm, or with no recommendation, then it goes to the full Senate. But what we were watching on TV was the committee hearing, and then the vote when Susan Collins gave her long, laborious speech about why that she was going to support the nomination. That was actually on the Senate floor.
Gotcha. Anyway, that was the point that I wanted to get out of that article, was that he knew how to frame things. And I just wanted to drive home the point that about when you're speaking to, even if it's the family next door, depending on their background, their children's situation, et cetera, you may have to deliver your message to them in a different fashion, whatever you're trying to peddle. If it's, hey, I'm your neighbor, I'm on the registry, or, you know, whatever else it is.
So I agree, and this article in the Times, New York Times, is a good one.
Yep. Then moving over to, I've never heard of this publication, but Inverse.com, and honestly, we don't even have to make it past the title of it, and it could be hyperbole, it could be clickbait, whatever, but the title is, Police Are One of the Leading Causes of Death for Young Men in the United States. They list some statistics in there, you can go verify them if you want to, but if you are a young adult, a young man in this country, you have interactions with the police, there is a much higher than average chance that you're going to end up not living much longer. And I that just bothers me that it shouldn't be that way, but somehow we've gotten to this stage.
Well, the statistics are bad for what happens. No one likes to see a fallen officer, but there are. The officers have, if you look at the statistics, there's a website that talks about fallen officers. And if you look at the statistically, and I know that some will criticize me and say that these are bogus, false, but this is the organization that advocates for helping fallen officers. The number of officers who have fallen in the line of duty has dropped precipitously since the 1970s. It is safer now to be a police officer than any time in recorded history. Well, we don't like to see a single police officer die. But on the other hand, other side of that, it is not safe. The statistics of what happens to you with a police encounter, now they're still exceedingly small. Most hundreds of thousands and millions of police encounters do not result in death. But statistically, on the other side of the ledger, the number of people dying at the hands of the police have gone up in the same time the number of officers has gone down. So you tell me what's going on.
Right. Mike, what do you have to say about all that?
Well, the way it's being framed, it makes it sound like all of these people that have interactions with the police don't are just walking down the street minding their own business, and all of a sudden a cop decides to shoot them or attack them or something. A lot of times people are breaking the law, and try to look at it from the cop's point of view sometimes. I understand that it is a problem, but is this really being blown out of proportion for political gain for some people?
Well, I don't think so. We enjoy having people with different opinions here, but I don't think so. I think that when you're walking down the street and you're profiled and you're asked, as a middle-aged white guy, you're never going to be asked, why are you in a particular neighborhood? They're not going to pull you over and do a pretextual stop. And they're not going to pull you over when you have your windows tinted and you got a little bit of thumping music. We just don't encounter that, so we can't relate to it. And at some point, you get tired of the police asking you, why are you here? What are you doing here? What's your business here? Let me run your ID, okay? You get held up for 30 minutes while they do that, and then they let you on your way, and then the next day, the same thing happens to you again. At some point, you find it a little irritating.
And it does happen to me as a middle-aged white guy. I go down to Newark sometimes, which is a really bad area in some places, and the police stop me all the time saying, why are you here? Because I'm a white guy in an area that's a major minority population.
So you're only going there
to buy drugs.
Right.
Exactly. And it just happens that one of my friends from prison lives in that area, and if I go to see him, you know, this happens to me also.
I understand.
But now I don't get pulled out. I don't get pulled out of the car. I don't get all of this. You know, they don't do this to me. But then again, when they ask for my license, yes, officer, why are you here? Visiting my friend. I don't get belligerent with them. I don't start saying stuff like, I'm not going to give you my license. I don't have to give you my license. At a roadside stop or any time with a police officer is not a time to start an argument with them. They have so much power and so much control over you, they can escalate a situation really bad. The best thing to do is be polite and courteous, and a lot of times that'll get you out of a lot of stuff.
I agree with you wholeheartedly on that part of what you said, that is not the time to have the confrontation. But do you like living in a country where they simply pull you over because you're in a place where there's no probable cause? Does being in a poor neighborhood driving through, is that enough for the police to detain you?
Well, do you call being pulled over for a stop being detained?
Well, that's a detention for whatever period of time.
Okay.
So, absolutely. You're being detained. So are you happy with your country where you believe that there should be, I assume that there should be at least some reasonably articulable suspicion or probable cause for a person to have to undergo a detention and an interrogation? Are you fine with that? If you are, that's fine with me, but I'm not.
Well, I would imagine that it would also depend on the area. If they find that a lot of white people are going to this black neighborhood to buy drugs, that is a valid profile, and maybe that is why they stop it, to try to stop people before a crime is committed. Does it get taken out of hand? Does it get taken to extremes? Yes. But I believe that some form of profiling is actually human nature.
It is, but I would argue that you have the presumption of innocence before anything, so there shouldn't be any sort of acceptable profile to just pull you over and go, why are you here? You have the First Amendment freedom of expression. You get to go hang out with whatever friend you want to go hang out with.
And I agree with you, but now would you rather them just pull random people over like they do in airports for random screening? Or would you rather have them focus on people that they think are more likely to be people that fit a certain criteria?
What is that criteria?
It all depends.
I can easily answer that. I would rather them abide by our Constitution and Bill of Rights, and that you don't hassle people until you have the requisite legal standard. That's what I would like the country I'd live in. So it's easier for me to answer.
Okay, so there's no legal standard for a police officer to pull somebody over.
Of course, if they have a tail light out, they can pull them over since they're operating a car. If they swerve over the center line, if they speed, there's a whole number of things pulling over. But if they're completely abiding by the law, and you don't have to manufacture something to pull them over for a pretextual stop just because you have an intuition, that's not the nation I want to live in. I don't want to live in a nation where you operate on intuition. I want you to have probable cause or at least reasonable suspicion. And the fact that you're a white guy driving through a black neighborhood, that doesn't make you there for drugs. That is not enough standing alone.
Okay, well, we just disagree on that. I mean, it does get taken out of hand. It could, the amount of interaction could be lessened, but I think that profiling in general might be a good thing. People do it all the time. If you're walking down the street and you see somebody that just, you get a bad feeling about it, are you going to say, well, that person might be good. He's given me no probable cause to think that he might be a danger to me. I'm just going to keep walking straight by him. Or might you just say, I'm going to cross the street just in case and walk on the other side of the street?
Larry, let me play devil's advocate with you for a moment. You often talk about people wearing bolts in their faces and tattoos and crazy hair and the way you dress. Isn't that profiling?
It absolutely is.
And
but
I don't
suppress any of their rights. I just choose not to deal with some of them. But I'm not interfering with their right of mobility. They can be anywhere they want to be. They can be in the theater. They can do anything they want to do. I'm surprised from a person who comes from a libertarian perspective, I'm told, would be so forgiving of the police state being able to intrude in people's lives and ask for an accounting of where they are. That just doesn't seem to be a consistency with the libertarian view, which is to let people live and let live and keep government out of their life. Can you square that one up for me?
Sure. It's not that I'm saying that they have the right to ask you all these personal questions. If a police officer comes to me and he says, well, we think you're here for drugs, and I tell him no, and he gets to look in my car, or not actually search it, but I mean, you know, with the little flashlight, look around. He doesn't see anything that that grabs his attention or whatever. Okay, you're free to go. It shouldn't be a lengthy stop. It should be a quick thing. You see somebody walking down the street with their pants hanging down all the time. Is that a fashion statement, or do they have something in their pockets that's really weighing them down like a gun?
That's a fashion trend as far as I know, and it also makes it significantly harder for them to run away.
Yes, it does.
But again, even if they have a gun weighing them down, that is the presumption that they are doing something illegal, and you don't have the power to detain them until you have evidence that they are doing something that you would detain them for, right?
That's where we disagree. I don't consider just being stopped on the street and ask a question or two as a detainment. If they put you in cuffs and put you in the back of the car and then they started searching your car without your consent, I'm fully against that.
I'm intrigued by this. So Larry, this is Fourth Amendment stuff. So this is search and seizure, right? I mean, even them talking to you, even having like the conversation, hey, I'm Officer So-and-so, can you show me your driver's license? This happened to me once. I was walking back from lunch. They were looking for somebody. I think they were looking for a tall white dude, and I fit that. So the cop just said, hey, can I see your driver's license? I handed it to me, and off I went. Does that cross the line of being detained?
Well, it was a,
I wouldn't consider that being detained.
It was a brief detention. It was brief detention,
yes.
But it was also based on something other than just a hunch. You, unless it was a pretextual stop where he wanted to run you through NCIC, he actually had something in the way of criminality of someone they were looking for. But you cannot view it as a detention. That's fine. But the courts have all ruled that when you're stopped at roadside and you're not allowed to proceed on your way, that is a detention for however brief of time. They're more lenient on the briefer the detention is, like at a roadblock where they're waving cars through and they look in briefly and they see if they can smell alcohol and they wave you on through. Those have been constantly upheld as being so brief that they're not very disruptive. But when you have to pull over, stop, show your license, wait for the officer to run your NCIC, then they bring the dogs to sniff your car, then they ask you to open the trunk so that they can go through all your stuff, and they do that repeatedly, that is a very much of an intrusion in your life, and that it happens in the minority community all the time. And like,
well, when you add all of that on there, when you add the bringing the dog around, opening the trunk to search, yes, then the libertarian view that I have says that's way too much. It shouldn't have gone that far. I'm talking about a simple stop. They ask you a question or two, and you're on your way within minutes, like less than 2 or 3 minutes.
Well, I think that violates a First Amendment challenge, too, because that's your freedom of expression.
I would invite you to ride in a minority neighborhood and see the difference in the detention that goes on and how extensive it becomes, and in terms of the searching and the getting out of their car, and for the officer's safety, how that they often put the person in handcuffs as they're standing by the car while they're searching the car and while they're bringing in the canine unit to see if they can smell drugs. It is a lot more, that type of stop happens a lot more in the minority community. And that's what brings the frustration level up.
Well, when you bring all those facts into account, then yes, I agree with you.
All right. We should probably move on before we beat this dead horse to, death.
All right. Sounds good.
All right. And this is from the Post Star, and it took me a minute to figure out who it was. I had to look up who this legislator was, and state assemblyman. That's the same thing, Larry. They just call them different in New York?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So this guy says that the low-level offenders are exploiting a loophole and not registering their internet identifiers. I think this guy is our jackass of the week, so to speak. And he says it is a public safety issue that puts our community members at risk. We cannot have registered sex offenders on social media sites without them reporting. This is not a partisan issue. It's something that both sides of the aisle can get behind. I think he's a jackass.
You're pretty good at that.
You like that?
Yeah.
Kind of passionate. This is stupid. This is stupid, asinine. I hate this. I hate this. I hate this.
So, well, now what exactly is he proposing? Just that they disclose that they're on social media or that they be banned?
No, he says that they need to reveal their social media accounts because they are not internet identifiers, such as an email address or direct messaging account. I don't know, man. I don't like any of these things. I don't think that you're going to have people that target people that they shouldn't be targeting. And, but I just don't think it's as rampant, to shut down, however many there are in New York. I don't think that this is at all going to be effective. Yes, it would save one, I'm sure. But as we see in the statistics over and over again, it's most often someone that is close to the family. It's not just some random that you encounter on the internet.
So, well, misguided public policy, giving people, a false sense of security would be what I would say if they're not banning social media, disclosing them. I mean, I'd rather there be no intrusion at all, but this is certainly below the level of just an outright ban, which has been tried and struck down by the courts. As far as I know, everywhere it's been tried, there's been different success on actually having just to provide the internet identifiers. In some cases, the challenge has been successful. In some cases, they have not been.
Do you happen to know any of the details, differences of the way that it got argued to be good versus bad, or successful versus not, as it were?
Well, I think it's more to do with the philosophy of the courts, where they say the arguments have been that it suppresses, you have the right to anonymity in speech, and this suppresses people's willingness to speak if they have to reveal how they would speak anonymously. And some courts have been more sympathetic to that argument than others have.
And yeah, that's what someone in chat just said. What about chilling anonymous political speech? That's what someone just wrote.
Yeah, that's what I would continue to argue.
So then let me put on the partisan hat. So New York being typically touted as being a super duper left leaning state, does that hold more water on the left side, or does it hold more water on the right side?
In the political environment of the legislature, it doesn't really hold. This could easily go through unanimously. What would have the best chance of stopping this from going through would be a good strong advocate organization there that would be respected enough that they could have conversations with both sides of the aisle. But if the law enforcement apparatus is telling them they need this, and the victims' advocates are saying they need this, and there's a shrill, fevered pitch political environment developed, and there's no one saying there's any problem with this, it's not likely. So I don't want to politicize this, because it's going to go through unanimously if there's no opposition, or almost unanimously.
Right. And as we keep saying, if it makes it through the committees and all that stuff and gets to a vote, it will go through. It has to be stopped before we get there.
Or if I don't know anything about New York legislative process, but sometimes you have a committee chair that gets it, or a powerful committee chair, or a powerful committee vice chair that gets it, and they will bottle something up and never let it see the light of day. That could happen, but those people are not going to magically get it if no one's helping them to get it. They need help, and I don't think that we have much in the way of advocacy in New York. One of those states where there's not a whole lot of, it's unfortunate. One of our largest states has very little way of advocacy.
Right. Mike, I actually do not understand. Can you clarify the way that you worded that question?
Yeah.
And read the question that you typed in there too.
Well, I did that kind of quick. My question basically is how, when you're on the registry, if you don't provide the correct information and everything, people get prosecuted left and right. But yet, has anybody ever been prosecuted for using the information that's on the registry to hassle one of us? That's my challenge, to find somebody that's actually been prosecuted for that.
I know the answer. Larry, go ahead. I know what your answer is going to be.
It certainly is not with any regularity that people get prosecuted. I can't say no one ever has, but it's not a high priority of most prosecution operations. Is to they're not spending their time going
I recall
people.
You saying something of like actually proving that, hey, I found this jackass on the registry, so I went and mowed him down. That's what that you've made some sort of statement along those lines before.
Well, Larry can appreciate this, because in New Jersey law, everything that has to deal with registration on our part says you shall do this or you shall do that. Shall is a very important legal term.
Yep.
But when it comes to people using the information against us, they may be prosecuted.
That is kind of funny.
I've never heard of that point. That's funny. Great.
That's pretty good. I can assure you that it's like vigilante justice. When someone does an act of vigilantism, if it's one of those acts of vigilantism that resonates with the public, being that prosecutors are largely elected in this country, it's very rare that they'll go after the vigilante. If they do, they go after the person with kid gloves, because the politics are running against them.
I see people putting stuff up about that on the Discord site now. I'm not really talking about the major things like this. I'm talking about like your neighbor that comes and puts a bag of crap in front of your door and lights it on fire because you're on the registry, or spray paint something on your car, something like that. I'm not talking about something that makes headline news.
And I'm pretty sure we could go back to like, how would you actually, I mean, is the person going to cop to saying that they found this information on the internet, so that's why they targeted the person? The person's gonna be like, oh, I just don't like this person because they leave their trash out the wrong way.
Right. I can understand that.
Well, it's an interesting thing to me. This thought's just now occurring to me, because I've talked about how I evolved on the hate crimes being elevated in terms of the importance. But it's interesting here, because this when you commit a crime against a person on the registry merely because you hate them because they're on the registry, I bet magically a lot of our people would see that that should be an elevated crime of importance because they're not just setting their house on fire because they want to watch a house burn down. They're setting their house on fire because they hate them because they're a sex offender and they're doing a willful disregard for human life. And magically, I bet people that say that hate crimes are not needed because it's already against the crime, against the law to burn a house down or to beat someone up because they're registered. I bet magically a lot of people would be in favor of escalating that at the level of importance. I'd be curious to hear feedback on that because to me that would be a very good analogy to why we have hate crimes laws.
Oh, are you looking for me?
We've got a lot of people out there who say, well, they don't need a hate crime. It's already against the law to bust somebody over the head. Well, yes, it is.
This is right.
But if you go out look for people to bust over the head because you don't like gay people and you're not really busting them overhead to take their money away from them because you want to get a drug fix, that you're just simply hate gay people so bad you're busting heads, that is a different level of offense in my view. That, well, I'm just wondering if you go out and bust someone over the head because they're on the registry, if the people who say that hate crimes are not needed, I'm wondering if magically they would do an about face and say, well, yes, that should be a more serious offense if you bust someone on the head simply because you found them on the registry. I wonder if they would be consistent.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
All right. Well, then let's move on to one of my favorite podcasts. It's incredibly well done. Is On the Media from WNYC. And they have something called a podcast extra. And so it's not like what you would normally hear on their Saturday or, you know, Friday shows, whatever. And but they've been doing a 3-part segment on repairing justice. And I totally just wanted to like lay it out there. Go find it. It's fairly recent in the last 2, 3, 4 weeks that these things have been out. They are amazing talking about how ineffective prison is and how violent it is and how people are basically screwed on the other side when they get out. It is a non-efficient way to try and get some level of rehabilitation into the system. And like I said, I just wanted to point it out to people because A, I love the show, but B, these are really specific segments that are related to us.
I didn't listen to it, but I plan to.
Oh, sweet. Man, I totally want to hear your take on it if you do.
All right. I do plan to.
Excellent. And then, of course, we have a War and Peace sized article from The Appeal. And this is Alabama life without parole denied freedom at the age of 52. And this is, as you like to call them, juveniles. This kid was sentenced at 17 for a mountain of time. And the Supreme Court, as I understand it, please help me get through this. But as I understand it, the Supreme Court said you cannot sentence kids to these kind of super duper long life without parole kind of sentences. And even after that, Alabama is still saying, nah, we don't want to give it to you. And this is over like a $40 robbery and some people ended up dying. But supposedly this kid didn't actually pull the trigger, but then he's an accomplice. So Alabama says, negative, not happening.
Well, at 17 years old, he was plenty old enough to know that he ought not have been hanging out with those kind of people. And he ought to have been able to figure out that something bad could have happened and that something bad happened. He's just as responsible because he was there. And I don't know why you bleeding heart liberals always want to come in and make excuses for people and justify them. He was old enough that he did the crime and he ought to do the time and quit complaining.
Oh shit. My bad. All right. So we're going to move on. Mike, feel free. Anything you got to think how to go in there with?
No, I'm staying at home.
So, well, actually, the Supreme Court ruled that not in his particular case, but they ruled that I think it was in a different case, that life without parole with no possibility of parole for a juvenile was unconstitutional. So But they didn't.
I agree with that.
They didn't say that you have to release every juvenile who's received that sentence. What they said was that they have to be given the possibility of parole. So Alabama said, all righty, we've given him the possibility. He can apply for parole and the board will consider him. So they considered him. They said, nope, he's not ready for it yet. So he gets to be considered again in 5 years, I think, if the article's right.
Yeah.
So there has not been a massive release of people because of this ruling. It's kind of like the California where the federal court said you're going to have to get your reduce your prison population. They didn't say you have to release a single offender. They said you have within the facilities you have, you can only have this number of people. And you can build more, you can do whatever you want to do, but you can't continue to overcrowd these at this level. Well, the Supreme Court didn't say you have to release anybody that's been sentenced to life without parole as a juvenile. They just said you have to give them the possibility of parole. So they've done that. They've created a process that says you can apply for parole, and lo and behold, he doesn't qualify.
Because somebody has a wild hair one day, and really the inverse. Someone has a wild hair to let him go, but they're just saying, no, not doing it, and probably never going to do it. Put this guy on the bottom of the pile for the next round, and he's still not going to get it, probably.
Yeah. So he'll be 57 when he'll be eligible to ask again.
And this is the awesome state of Alabama. Awesome state.
It says while the board will occasionally consider a prisoner's case, earlier recent actions by the Alabama governor and the legislature have made Kinder's a chance of an earlier hearing unlikely. In October of 2018, Governor Kay Ivey issued a moratorium on early parole after the parole board released a man who then murdered three people. And see how one person can cause the entire system to stop because of the actions of one. Now, the police always tell you just the opposite. They say, now, we might have a bad officer now and then, but no, you should not judge the whole force because of one bad officer. We're fine people. And I agree with that. But I wish they would do the same thing. I wish law enforcement would say, well, wait a minute. Now, we release hundreds of people on parole every year, hundreds, if not thousands, and they don't go out and kill people. So we shouldn't throw the entire system away because of the actions of one. Let's try to figure out what we missed in that one. I wish they would have the same attitude when it's looking back towards them. But I know that's wishing for something I'll probably never see.
Chris in chat says, damn it, Larry, you're so right. There you go, Larry. You have a fan in chat.
Well, Larry, there are some police that are actually showing very good restraint. I mean, in New York City, a lot of them are getting water thrown on them, and they're not even responding. And I think that's an outrage.
Well, I would tend to agree that they should not be assaulting the police, and I think that an appropriate level. The problem is there's been the escalation by police of the heavy-handed response. Throwing anything at a police officer is uncalled for in their line of duty. You don't have the right to do that. I think that's over the top. But they're under immense political pressure. They're in New York under de Blasio because they're trying to correct the over-excesses of the police. And this is probably an overreaction if the police are not responding to that. But you also don't need to respond by turning the dogs loose and beating them down. Right. And pushing their head into the concrete and knocking their teeth out. And you don't have to go to that extreme of putting them in a van and riding them around town and causing them to fall because you're doing hard turns and all that kind of stuff. That's an overreaction.
And those are the police that should be fired.
But we can't get that at all. I mean, time and time again, maybe, you know, on the outside of that, one or two of them have been prosecuted, but the dude in New York City.
They never get convicted, hardly ever. The jury's won't guilty.
But just that cat that was selling cigarettes on the street. Yes, he may have been belligerent. He may have been resisting. He may have been doing something illegal. But for Pete's sakes, man, it's not a death sentence. And that is ridiculous to have it was like six officers corralling around the guy, kind of like pushing on him and all this stuff. And he's like, I can't breathe. I can't breathe. Dude dies. That's insane to me that this should happen.
So
I agree.
So, but yes, this is an unfortunate thing with this young man in Alabama, just because he killed somebody. And I know this sounds silly, but the recidivism rate on murder is very, very low, very low. And since he didn't actually do the murder, and everybody concedes that point, to lock him up for something right. that he was a part of this many years ago, and just simply to continue to deny him any chance at life is disgusting. And you folks in Alabama that are listening ought to be ashamed of yourself.
All right. And, you know, I call things my quote unquote favorite article of the week or my favorite person. And it's usually me being like, this is so asinine and ridiculous or abhorrent. And I just don't have like a better way to phrase it. And here we go. A man helped a lost toddler find her parents, police say. He was smeared online as a predator and fled town. My understanding of this story is there's like at a little league baseball game or something like that there in town. And this guy notices that there's a kid. He's not even one of our people, man. He's just like a normal Joe. And he sees this kid like wandering off. So he tries to figure out who the kid belongs to. And obviously got the kid returned. But then everyone's like, oh, this is a pedophile. He's trying to abduct our kid. And they start posting up on Facebook like, hey, watch out for this dude. And all this. And like the guy's getting death threats. And all this, and this is just, we have turned our society into, are you just supposed to let the kid run away and get hit by a car? Would that be the acceptable response now? I'm not going anywhere near a kid if I see them out. This actually happened to me a couple of years ago. Like, a kid from down the street was walking around just in his diaper. Someone knocks on my door, is like, hey, do you know whose kid this is? I'm like, I'm not going anywhere near that kid. That's like freaking kryptonite to me. And I just close the door. That's like... That's not how society is supposed to work.
Well, this is an older article from 17. Has there been any developments of a recent nature?
You know what? That is totally my fault. I didn't even notice that. Someone just posted it and I grabbed it. So I don't have a development on it. Oh, man.
The point you're making is still a valid one. I remember something in school, and somebody in chat will help me with it, but there was a royal person who was dying, and the peasants, the common people weren't allowed to touch the royalty, and so they let the king or the queen or whoever it was drown. And this is so many years ago, but I remember something in school where it was this is an example of that. So I guess you're supposed to just let a kid be in harm's way. Because if you do anything otherwise, they're going to crucify you as being a pedophile or a predator.
Yeah, and they called him a predator and like made the news and all this crap. And so the dude had to like skip town, which is crazy.
So,
go ahead, Mike. Tell me why we're wrong. Just saying.
Actually, I agree with you. If I'm in a Walmart and I see a kid by themselves, I'll look to the nearest... adult woman, and I'll say, is that your kid? If not, maybe you should keep an eye on it.
Yeah.
I'm going to go to the next aisle over.
And as far as all of that goes, at least there are 18 gajillion cameras in a Walmart that you could always have. You should be able to get the evidence to be supportive of your actions, or hopefully not the other side of that where you don't have it support your actions.
No, any evidence in my favor is either going to be lost or damaged.
Will in chat says that the father beat the crap out of this dude, and he gave me the article link, but he deleted it. He says he did, and that would make this even more abhorrent-er.
Well, yeah, that's in the article, but I can just about bet you the father didn't get prosecuted. What do you bet?
I'm searching for the word beat, and I didn't find it in the article. So, yeah, I mean, he probably didn't because of the rage and all that from like almost pleading insanity from killing your wife when you walk in on her cheating on you, something like that. So yeah, does he get to plead some sort of temporary insanity?
Well, but they're never going to prosecute him. It says the man who also, now I have shoe ads popping up because I bought some shoes recently. Took over my screen.
There you go. Thank you, internet.
The man was also punched by the child's father, who told local media that he thought he was trying to take my daughter and he wanted to kill him, quote.
I did see the punch part. Okay, I was looking for the wrong word.
Yeah, so, but what do you bet he wasn't prosecuted?
That's a good question. That's a good question.
I bet he wasn't.
I agree with you. So, there we are.
If I was in that position and he punched me, I would have fell over so hard. I would have been rolling over screaming in pain. Yeah. I would have got an Academy Award for that, and I would have took him to civil court.
Well, that would cross the line into criminal, right?
I want to be a criminal, but his point is he wants to try to bleed the man dry. He may not have a pot to piss in, though.
True. And my apologies for pulling something out. I didn't vet the date. I just came up on the radar and I was like, what? Larry, do you want to read your statement before the El Chapo thing or after?
Well, we do have an article here about the Metropolitan Correctional Center, and it'll be in the
it's
show.
It's also
notes.
Old.
It goes back to earlier this year, I think,
2017. No, that's the one I have for the Manhattan Jail holding El Chapo.
Okay, well I was thinking I'd found a more recent one, but I was finding something to try to convey what that facility is like. And this is someone who said they'd been in this and Guantanamo. This is worse than Guantanamo, according to that person. Now, I haven't been in Guantanamo, nor have I been in the Metropolitan Correctional Center. So I don't speak with any personal experience, but the Manhattan Jail, the Federal Metropolitan Correctional Center, does not have a stellar reputation for being club fed. So earlier in the podcast, we talked about the death of Jeffrey Epstein, and I had decided for the first time ever that I was going to write something so that I wouldn't be rambling. Hopefully I can deliver it succinctly, and then those in chat and anybody who wants to chime in can do so. But I think today is a sad day for our country, for those who cherish our Constitution. I deeply believe in the presumption of innocence, and that the presumption of innocence follows a person through the duration of the process until the accused person either pleads guilty or is convicted by a jury. Despite the protest of victims' advocacy organizations, this is the America I believe in. I will continue to state that at every opportunity I have to do so. I also deeply believe that a person who is presumed innocent should be released pending trial so that he or she can assist with their own defense. There's no question that a person held in detention cannot adequately have the resources and the connections to permit him or her to assist with preparing for trial for a person who is not in custody has a great advantage. Prior to the Bail Reform Act of 1984, it was fairly uncommon in the federal system for people to be held in detention unless the person could not post a monetary bond. That all changed when President Reagan signed the Bail Reform Act into law. The Bail Reform Act made it possible for the prosecution to move for pretrial detention regardless of whether the person could post bail. The Supreme Court upheld the Bail Reform Act in 1987 on a 7-2 vote in the case of United States versus Salerno. Now, after more than three decades of the Bail Reform Act, nearly everyone accused of a federal crime is subject to some type of confinement pending trial, which can range from house arrest to halfway house or even in a correctional center as in the case of Mr. Epstein. In this case, Mr. Epstein was relegated to the Metropolitan Correctional Center in Manhattan, which is one of America's toughest prisons. And remember, he's innocent. The victim's advocates will say Epstein was a coward and that he took the easy way out. Of course, they're entitled to that opinion. I vehemently disagree. I believe that Jeffrey Epstein probably was totally dejected once he recognized that the American system he believed in does not actually exist. He presented many options for his pretrial release that were categorically rejected by the court because to grant release would have enraged the victim's advocates who do not share my belief in our Constitution's presumption of innocence. I believe that this prosecution was driven by greed, desire for fame, and class envy, which is sad. In addition, Mr. Epstein complained about the harsh conditions he was subject to at the Metropolitan Correction Center. Could it be that he gave up on life once he realized that the system does not care? I thought our supporters claimed that we favor improving conditions in our jails. If that's what we really believe in, then how can we say that anyone deserves this? The ultimate tragedy is that we will never know if the government had a strong case against him or if they simply filed charges to satisfy the angry mob. This is the same angry mob that drove Alex Acosta from his job as President Trump's labor secretary for his decision not to federally prosecute Epstein years ago. My final comment is that our system of justice has lost, and only the people alleging to have suffered abuse at Epstein's hands will win. He is now dead, which opens the door for many to make allegations which may or may not be true. The angry mob will feed on the carcasses of the Epstein estate until it's completely decimated, and then they will go after the insurance companies next. It is with sadness that I am probably one of the few that will see the long-term damage that this does to our nation. Just add this to the abolition of statute of limitations and the constant erosion of the right of confrontation, which victims' advocates say is re-victimization. It's a sad day for me.
So on that note, though, so the article that I picked, and you can probably find 100 sources for this one, but Jeffrey Epstein dies of suicide while awaiting a new sex trafficking trial. Obviously, that's the big news of the day. And you're not going to find a tear shed probably by just about anybody for this guy going down as far as like the victims advocates go.
Well, they don't believe in the Constitution. If they did, they would not take the extreme positions they take. Jeffrey Epstein is presumed innocent. And a person who is innocent should not be put subject to the most extreme punishment that we can possibly inflict on them in one of the toughest jails we have. And his trial was set, I think, for about a year from now. And the attorney said that that wouldn't even be enough because they expected to have over a million pages of discovery to cull through because of the extensive investigation that's gone on for the past year.
And I just remembered. So we had Judge Persky, and I don't remember was it New Jersey? Who was the case that we just talked about with the kid?
New Jersey. Yes.
So that judge stepped down as well. And then Acosta, and I'm sure this has happened in other places. Those are just the ones that I can remember off the top of my tongue. Those are people that the angry mob has kicked out because of a lack of due process in any of this.
Well, they don't believe in due process. That's the whole problem. They believe just the opposite. They believe that the accusation is a conviction in their mind, and they have convinced the majority of the people that they're actually confronting a person who makes an accusation that is re-victimization and that shouldn't happen. And they forgot that our founding fathers intended it to be difficult to put people in a cage and to take away liberty. And it was better for guilty people to go free than for innocent people to be caged up. They don't believe in all that. They don't have the same belief structure that I do. And they have the right, of course, to have any belief system that they have. I disagree with them, and I think that the Constitution supports my view.
Well, Larry, I can give you a quick libertarian response to that. I agree with everything you just said. I think part of the reason that we get to this point is because people call those people victims. If the guy wasn't convicted of a crime, is there really a victim yet?
They are alleged victims, but.
Right. Why are we using that term? These words mean things. And when you use terms like that, it flares up the public. So when people claim that they're victims and everything, it just, like you said, it just makes people automatically assume that the other person is guilty.
That is correct. But if you use the term alleged victim, then the victim's advocates come after you and say, well, that shows you that you don't have any concern. You're on the side of the criminal. You don't.
No, you're on the side of the law.
Oh, well, but that's our position. But that's not their position. The victim's advocates have won this battle. They've convinced public opinion that due process is too expensive, it's too grueling, and it's too traumatizing, and that we don't need all that. That's all hocus pocus as far as they're concerned.
Do you feel there's any path to not victory, success to changing the mindset in this regard?
No. I've seen scant evidence that our population is becoming more sophisticated in terms of the dangers. I think that each time there's an erosion and further encroachment and it makes it easier to convict people, I see public opinion being supportive of that. I don't see the public saying, well, wait a minute, I could be next. I don't hear the angst that I should hear if people were getting it. I don't think they're getting it, no.
And so along with the registry in general, you know, with all of the people that keep getting scooped up into the dragnet, that sort of seems, well, you know, like the lady that was on the call in Georgia forever ago, she's like, well, my son's not a sex offender. And you're like, excuse me, did he get convicted of a sexual offense? Well, yes, but he's not one of those people. And you're like, then he's a sex offender. So I'm wondering if this isn't sort of similar, that eventually people will be like, whoa, stop the train. There will just be enough critical mass for the tides to turn, maybe,
but how do we undo this stuff? Because once you've put stuff in statute and the courts have upheld, the courts really can't protect us on the statute of limitations, because that's not a constitutional right. You don't have the right to a statute of limitations. So once that's been placed in statute, where they've either abolished it or severely weakened it to extend it for 30 years or something ridiculous like that, how do you undo that in a political climate?
I think what we need to do is take a rule like they have. I don't know if they still have it, but in England, you used to not be able to comment about anybody involved in a criminal complaint until the whole thing was resolved. Either there was a guilty or a not guilty verdict.
How would you do that? How would you square that with our First Amendment right? The press would scream bloody murder that the public has a right to know that these people have been, that they're facing justice and what they've been accused of doing. How would you square that with the, I mean, the press would be all over that. I mean, I agree with you. I think restricting what's the devastation that's done to people would be a good thing, but how would we square that?
Well, whose rights are more important? Are individual rights or collective rights more important? I mean, that's where we get to all these discussions, and it leads to all different types of problems. Like, a gay person that wants to have a baker bake a wedding cake, and he's saying that his religious objections don't permit him to do that. So whose rights are more important, his religious rights or the gay couple's rights to purchase an item? That's we're getting into very dangerous grounds, and we really need to step back and look at these things.
I agree with you on that. And I think that since I'm defense wired, I would err on the side of protecting the accused. The power of the government, the state, is enormous. The accused power, even for someone like Epstein, all those people out there who are just chomping at the bit that, you know, that he didn't get released on bail. This is a clear example of having money didn't make any difference. He had the best lawyers. He put forth the best arguments. He offered to pay for government provided security. And surrender his means to travel and do everything so that he could be out pending trial, which is what our Constitution, if you look at the Eighth Amendment, it says no excess. I can't quote it word for word, but something about no excessive bail should be required. Well, I read that if you don't allow bail, that would be considered excessive in my mind. I mean, maybe I'm just reading too much into the Eighth Amendment, but I think a zero bail is excessive if you make it so the person can't get out. But now, since the Bail Reform Act and the Supreme Court upheld it in 87 on a 7-2 vote, they said that actually that the Eighth Amendment did not provide a right to bail. It just it provided a right to not excessive bail. So if you just don't set bail, then it's not excessive, according to the Supreme Court.
I can't imagine in a country that we are ruled by laws that people divvy these, they get into these things into such minutia that it doesn't make sense anymore. I mean, it's like, can I take the blue pill or the red pill now, please?
So, well, I don't know how we were drifting away, but how do we undo this stuff? If there is that sudden light go off and people say the pendulum has swung too far, and we've got how do we undo this? Because unlegislating this stuff is going to be very hard.
I don't know that, and that's what scares me.
And you could never get something to rise across and make a constitutional amendment. There's no way that you would get 30 whatever states to ratify something like that. Never.
Isn't it 37 states? It's 3/4 of the states. I think it's 37.
I can't do 3/4 of 50 in my head, man.
So I believe it's 37.
It's a lot of states.
it's got to go through both houses on a 2/3 vote, and then it goes out. The president doesn't get to sign a constitutional amendment or veto it. It goes out to the states, for ratification. But and then that's another political process in and of itself. It has to take place in the states. But I believe it's 37 states.
Isn't. Is it common for like 7 years for statute of limitations? Even that's an arbitrary number. You know, it's just kind of a made up thing.
Well, there's no commonality. It depends on the level of the offense. State. Yeah, there's in Maryland, for example, there's no statute of limitations for felonies. And we may have a Maryland listener, but it's been that way for a number of years. But states are just lining up one after another to abolish the statute of limitation after these high profile cases like Hastert and the doctor that I can never remember his name.
Nassar.
Yeah. It's a snowball. It's difficult to stop because the victims have enormous, enormous clout when they come in and they start whining about how that something happened to them 12 years ago. Nobody would believe them. So therefore they kept it quiet and they deserve justice. And it's just difficult to say no. I mean, there's nobody standing there saying, well, I represent the accused people. I mean, and they can't get justice. There's no one pushing back on this stuff.
And then the, and you can go after this, Mike. What was I going to say? Oh, and then it's a slippery slope. So I always use jaywalking because it's the most stupid thing. But, you know, how far that then pulling, you know, so maybe you make it for murder, there's no statute of limitations. And you pull that back, you keep pulling it back. And then eventually, hey, there's no statute of limitations for you jaywalking. And you get people getting felony convictions for jaywalking 11 years ago.
Well, I'm not sure jaywalking is a felony level offense.
I know, but the slippery slope thing is what. You know,
give it time.
I know, right?
So, well, in Alabama, it very well could be because they have some pretty harsh laws in the South, particularly Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana. So,
well, we've been going downhill as far as our rights are for a long time. And a lot of this started a long time ago, when you're supposed to have the right to confront your accuser in court, and they're having all these rape shield laws. Where does the balance go on being able to confront your accuser and yet not re-victimizing somebody? What if she isn't really a victim and making it up?
Well,
there's
no such thing as re-victimizing somebody in my book. That is mumbo jumbo, hogwash. Our system is predicated upon the person who makes the accusation, whether you say that they embezzled. What would happen if you ran a business and you detected you'd missed $60,000, and the police came out and said, well, we want to see your audit trails, we want to see this, we want to see, you're re-victimizing me. I mean, you're making an accusation that, and you're pointing out a suspect that you think your bookkeeper did this, and they need to actually see that a crime happened. And that's not re-victimizing you to say we need evidence. We need evidence. You're wanting to put your bookkeeper in jail. We need some evidence. So that's an all made up imaginary thing about victimization. You're supposed to be confronted with the accusation you're making against someone. You're supposed to undergo cross-examination to see if there's a motivation for you telling an untruth. So I don't buy into anything about re-victimization. It is not re-victimization. It's just like the sex offender who says, I'm responsible for the unconstitutional laws you made. We should never say that we agree that it's re-victimization. It is not re-victimization. It is the American system of justice. We have an adversarial system. Do not ever concede that it's victimization. It is not.
And I agree with you 100%.
And in terms of going downhill, the reason why I brought up the Bail Reform Act, because this passed with significant margins. I was quite young in 84, and I don't remember what the margins were, but it was significant margins because we were worried about crime, and we were worried about those soft-hearted judges turning people loose, and we needed to put some controls on the judges so the federal judges would not let everybody out so they could continue to wreak havoc on society. But this was the beginning of the slippery slope that states are following now with their bail reform, including my own. You know, up until a couple of years ago, we didn't have any. You couldn't set a no bond hold on anybody. But now we're holding people left and right here pretrial with no bond holds.
All right, then. Anything else, Mike?
No, you guys are running really long. I don't want to keep Larry that time.
No, a couple of weeks ago, man, we had like a 150 podcast. We're only at 120, so we're good. No. Larry, do you have anything else before we shut it down?
I thought some people in chat might want to respond to my rambling statement.
I've been stoking the flames as we've been going. I think they've all quieted down for now. I threatened to ban somebody for not liking my 11-teen comment, so they've all quieted down. I cracked the whip.
Well, we are just doing well with our addition of new patrons. I don't remember if we got in this week, but we've had several recent weeks, and we appreciate you. And how do we get this podcast to just soar to new levels, Andy?
We need everyone that listens to go out and share it with their two friends, and they'll share it with two friends, and so on and so on and so on. I believe that Captain Crazy, he told me that he needed us to make sure that we had a super duper awesome over the top podcast because he was going to have a buddy of his over listening, and he hasn't shared with me whether he is or not. But that is how. I need you people to go help us share it. spread the word, because there are a whole lot of us out there that, I mean, I can't reach everybody. Larry can't reach everybody. Brenda can't reach everybody. Mike can't reach everybody. So if you guys could help pass the word along, just politely say, hey, there's this podcast. It is the most important thing impacting your life right now. And then we can grow our numbers. That's how to do it. And send them over to registrymatters.co. That's the website.
Well, I'm going to...
And I met Larry's challenge. I actually gave him, gave you guys my gross, over my gross income for the month when my gross income is zero.
Yes, he exceeded gross, Larry, because he's unemployed.
Well, I'm going to ask the Narsol affiliates in a polite email to provide a link to them to ask them to push it out to their list, and perhaps they will, perhaps they won't. They certainly don't have to, but that'd be another way we could, if the affiliates will let people know that there's a new episode, that would help. And remember that the views expressed on this podcast are not the views of the affiliates of Narsol or Narsol itself. They are the views of the team here.
So, Larry, how can people reach out and leave us some voicemail?
And if I don't get a voicemail this week, we're going to shut this podcast down. 747-227-4477.
And our email is registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And Larry, of course, we were just speaking about it. Mike offered to give us his net or gross, whichever one that was. And how do they get there?
That would be at patreon.com/registrymatters.
All right. And before we go, Mike, you wanted to give out your email address so people could write to you to find out more about the CDL stuff.
Yeah, just put it in the show notes. I'm going to mess it up.
Okay. It's
And people are going to curse me out for getting the wrong information.
All right. Well, for those of you, it's mdaskey@optimum.net. That's what you gave me. And with that, Larry, thank you very much for joining us. And Larry, as always, thank you. And I hope you guys have a great weekend, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Andy.
Okay, thank you.